Mr. Hayes, Real Six. We were talking about when you'd taken up a position in a field outside Sher, and you'd had a warning from Lieutenant Brownlee, Steele Brownlee, we know him as, but yeah. And he had you actually put on the camouflage nets at this stage? How did you put them on?
Well, they were rolled up, and you threw them from the back, rolled them across the vehicle, and then spread them out each side. They were quite big, actually. And because we'd never used them, they were tinder dry, absolutely bone tinder dry. And they were the mesh about that with hessian weaved in them.
Now, so they were on, and then Smith Brownlee warned you that this field had been regularly stonked.
Yeah. So anyway, I went back and I said to Joe Nickel, I said, there was a slit trench about 6 yards away from the truck, and I admit what I did was just claiming the point of Emerald Bighead. And I took my ground sheet out of the canopy, and I went home and I said to Joe, when anything happens, this is mine. Because there are a lot of slit trenches on the field that the infantry had been using, obviously. And the next thing is, these morning minis, and they were, first time we'd heard them, and they were a horrible sound. You know, they sort of moaned, and they'd come in from a place, I think, because on our right-hand side, and they were multiple barrel things.
And these are Nebelwerfers.
Nebelwerfers, yeah. And anyway, they landed and old hell was let loose. And that is where one must have landed very near to where I was. And it must have just knocked me out. Or I think it did anyway, because I don't remember a damn thing after that. So I woke up with these 53rd Welsh people. Well, I woke up in not a slip trench as such. It was more like a foxhole, which was deep. A deep pill, as opposed to a very shallow one. And I woke up, and vaguely I could remember something happening on the field, but when I woke up, and I don't know how long it was after, and I looked through this hedge, it was just off the main field, and there were these two 53rd Welsh people. You know, wouldn't call them rifle, privates. And I said, what happened? He said, well, when all that landed, he said, we were off the field, so it didn't affect us. But when they started to move the wagons off and that, and you discarded the camouflage nets because they were all on fire. You know, you'd only got to a mortar land within 20 yards, and it was, you know, the explosion would set these things that were tinder dry. And I looked up, and there was not a wagon left on the field. What couple that were, you know, had burnt out. So anyway, I said, well, what happened? And he said, well, we weren't paying particular attention, but he said, they scrambled off it eventually. So I stayed there for a while, and I said, well, what happened to you? So he said, I don't know why they said he was been there 2 days or 3 days. I think it was 2 days. He said, we've been here for 2 days. And he said, we came forward with a reconnaissance section. And he said, what you mean? And I knew what division they were with. And he said, there were four of us. There was an officer, a sergeant, and two, you know, riflemen, I don't like to go on. And he said, one of these, you know, sort of mortars landed, and our officer and the sergeant were killed outright. So we said, we just sat tight. You know, we didn't know where we were going. We were going forward, obviously in the direction of Hill 112, which I realised after that they were on the left-hand side somewhere. And anyway, after a while, I said, oh, God, I said, I'll have to go back and find the unit. He said, what for? I said, find you. I said, I don't want to be found with you two. You've been here 2 days. So I got up. I knew the general direction, but when the whole scene seems to have altered. And the field as you say, a field like that. And I was walking there to, the entrance should have been there somewhere, and I walked there. And on that ridge there, there were riflemen lying prone, what's them, with a rifle in front of them. And the comment I got from them, and I don't know where it came from, I know some of them said it, what the hell have you been playing at? Because I had a tank ready on, and a, you know, we always carried sidearms. And he said, one of the German tanks got through here and gave us a right pasting, and I don't know where it came from. I said, well, I said, don't blame me. And as I walked away, we put wire down, you know, but low wire.
Barbed wire.
Barbed wire, yeah. And I ripped my trousers right the way across one leg. So I thought, oh, hellfire. So eventually I found my way back to the unit. And it was more by good luck and good management that I found them, because they were, ooh, a couple of miles back by then.
Were they in Lager?
They were in Lager, yeah. But anyway, so somebody said to me, well, did you report to them? I said, oh, well, the wagon I was with came relatively unscathed, all my stuff was on it, so what was the point? Which, I mean, I'm glad I didn't have to start answering questions on that point, because I might have been stupid enough to say where I'd been, in the actual situation I'd been in. They went forward, the unit went forward again the next day, I think, up towards 112, around there. But eventually...
Did you go with them to Hill 112?
Yeah, eventually we did. And we stayed there 2 days.
What do you remember of that?
I remember getting stomped a lot. And
you were with your lorry?
Yeah.
Now, what were you doing? What was your job then with this lorry, this ammunition lorry? What did you actually have to do?
Well, that was just a matter of waiting until somebody said we were short of ammunition and we'd actually go up to them. But they'd come back to us. We wouldn't go forward.
So you'd go forward to the lager? You wouldn't go to the front line position, obviously.
No. We'd go to the lager. But anyway, it was a strange thing. I mean, you'd think that you were so tensed up that you wouldn't sleep. I slept like a log, whatever was thrown at us. I'd gone through the panic side of it. And I'd come through the other side, I think. Thank God I did. But
now, what happened on Hill 112 then?
The tanks were...
They were up on the...
We could see them on the ridge ahead of us. But then they decided, I don't know why they did it, they would put us on the left into the orchard place. So we managed to wangle into these orchard places.
This is the A echelon went there.
Yeah, B echelon, I don't think even crossed the river at that particular point. Wherever it was we crossed. And it was quite a distance from that, you know, from Shear to up onto Hill 112. And the whole sections of them, you get one solitary engineer or pioneer corps fellow filling a hole in, you know, and then miles of nothing. And I thought, this is a bit eerie. Anyway, eventually we got up and I got talking to, there was an anti-tank gun up on there, and went talking to the crew, and I said, I hope you weren't sitting there when that all came through your what's-name plate. No, fortunately, we weren't. But I don't know what unit they were with. But anyway, eventually, we went through into this orchard place, and I saw something there, which was a rerun of Dad's Army, of Jonesy shouting, don't panic. And that was the other... another padre from a different unit, and I have a feeling he was the RC padre, and I have a feeling that he might have got killed later on. And he was knocking on a bit, and our padre never wore his tin hat, never. But this fellow had his tin hat on, he was quite a wiry sort of fellow, he was running from tank to tank, don't panic. I thought, you're a lot of help, padre. Our fellow would never have done the same sort of thing. And then we stayed there for so long, and then suddenly they heard the phone loose, and they said, right, we're going back.
Now, you said you got stonked a lot. That was in that orchard, was it?
No, mainly in the field. I think that's probably why they moved us.
That was before?
Stonked before. But nothing personal about it. You know, we weren't being They were just at random every now and then.
So you didn't get shelled or Nebbleworthed in this orchard?
Not up there. No, no. There were others.
Okay, so what happened next then?
Well, the tanks were supposed to go on to Eversley and Eskate, which were down below Hill 1 and 2. Don't know how they got there. And suddenly they said, and without as much as daily, we're going back. Didn't say why, but, you know, found out after why. Because they'd either heard on from where they broke that code. What do they call it?
You wouldn't have known that then?
No, we wouldn't have known it then. And they decided that the Germans were putting in a big counterattack, and they didn't want the armoured unit to be cut off there. So they decided they would put more anti-tank guns in, plus whatever they've got, but withdraw the armoured brigade. And anyway, we went...
That's back across the river?
Yeah, yeah. And then, from there...
Well, did that withdrawal go all right? I mean...
The what?
The withdrawal, did it...
Oh, yeah. Rather quick, but nevertheless, it went all right. But they got out of the trap that the Germans were setting for them, obviously. You know, they were doing a sweep round that would have got round the back of us. And, but then... We were drawn out of that in preparation for, could have been Goodwood, I don't know.
It would have been, yeah. There seems to have been about a week or so, two weeks, when you're in places like Norrie and Colville, Grainville. I mean, I don't know whether you remember anything about that period.
But we weren't in action, we were withdrawn from action. And then, obviously, they were going up for Goodwood. And
so far, your main experience of being under fire had been in this field with the Nebel workers.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know whether we ever. There was somebody on the radio the other day wanted to build a memorial on Hill 112 for all the tanks that were lost. I don't know where many tanks lost on Hill 112 myself. Might have been on.
Now, what do you remember of what you were doing during? You were still with your mate as second driver or second man.
Yeah, yeah.
And what do you remember of Operation Goodwood for you then? That was 17th, I think, of July.
Very little, because the
18th of July. Sorry.
Because we started to move forward, and then the tanks went ahead, and obviously they crossed the river in the middle of the night, I think. Or what was it, the Calm Canal or something, wasn't it? Or whatever. And, but we were still on our way because we got held up by other units crossing our path. And, you know, it was a very complicated exercise getting the different units into place. And to some extent, well, I think the implication was at the time that some of the units were dragging their heels. I.e. the 7th Armoured. But, I mean...
Now, where were you? You were staying...
We were on our way from our assembly area to that bridgehead. But, we went across the next morning after the battle. It only lasted a day, really, the big battle. And we crossed the next day, and I saw... that was when I went out and saw the half track there. The fitter's half track, and I went over and said, you know, what's going on and what can we do? And he said, well, there's a tank there. They'd obviously come back, they'd towed it back or something, hadn't it? But it still wasn't fully operative, so they wanted to change the bogey wheels on it.
Now, can you tell me how you did that? Because that's quite a big job.
Yeah. Well,
if you just tell it like you did off tape, tell me that.
Well, what you did, you put this gadget that the Americans had designed, which was like an upturned... Like a horseshoe, but with square edges, to be square, instead of being round, squared off. It's quite a heavy piece of equipment. And you put that, the base of it, on the track, inside the track. And you put the two arms, which are about that long, up against the part that held the bogey wheels. And then, I can't remember exactly how it is, then you either got the driver to drive forward or back, as the case may be. But you'd have to give him hand signal, because if he went too far over the point of, you know, balance, he would really jam the track up. So it was a two-man job. And once you got them up, it lifted the bogies off the track, so you could do something with the thing, because you couldn't, if you didn't lift that part up, even if you undid the bogey, you would never get it off the track. And I think that changed one or two of them. And anyway, the next thing, I went over and I said, okay, Robbie, I've done those two bogies. I've a feeling somehow that the tanks used to carry two spare bogey wheels on the front. I'm not quite sure about that. And put a hell of a weight. And but what you used to do was put the pin through and get your mate, whoever was doing it, to carry one side of it and then carry it between them. But anyway, then they said, okay, we're going back to... They never got any specific places. You just, we're going back.
Now, were you aware of how many tanks had been lost at the time? Because they lost nearly all of them, didn't they?
Well, when we got back to the assembly area, we realised, and the number of crews that we lost as well. Because the one thing is very seldom mentioned in the books, but it was told about it by the people that were there, was when they staggered back and bedded down for the night under the gliders, and the Germans bombed the glider field, what we used to call the glider field, and there was a lot killed there of the crews that had managed to get out of their tanks. And it was a tragic loss, that, because they thought they were safe, and I think it was raining, if I remember, and they were anything for shelter. Some strange things happened. One fellow was evacuated, and he came back to the unit after, and I said, where were you wounded? He said, I wasn't. Well, how the hell were you evacuated then? So he said, I was helping one of my mates back, and he was bleeding profusely, so he said, oh, my uniform was caked as well. And he said, sitting down outside after he posted him in the tent, and he said, oh, I think I'll go and see if I can find a cup of tea. So he wandered in the tent and sat down. Somebody came along and tied a tag on him, and he was evacuated. And he came back about 2 months after. I said, well, did nobody question me? He said, no, I wasn't going to argue with him. So anyway, he was evacuated and sent back when we realised all he had was a bloody uniform. Nothing more, than that. But
Were you helping with any other, helping the fitters with anything else during that thing? There must have been a lot of damage.
Yeah, there was an awful lot of work to do. It was making sure the charges worked and this worked and that worked, because the tanks were coming in from the FDS, the full delivery squadron.
So it wasn't so much you were looking at the old ones as you were looking at the new ones.
The what's name came in, the recovery people, tank recovery, which was a different unit as apart from us, because, I mean, there were a lot of them that were not worth recovering. I mean, and obviously in the tanks that were there was a lot of dead bodies, which wasn't a... One of my neighbours down here was with the unit. Well, how did that happen?
So, the recovery of tanks wasn't anything to do with
no,
you.
No.
Was by this time, were you aware of the that they caught fire? I mean...
Yes. Because a lot of them, you know, came back and said, oh, so-and-so was badly burned. They reckoned if somebody went, you know, just tapped against the outside of the tank, the crew would be out if they wanted to survive. And
You were helping with checking the new tanks,
yeah,
were you?
Yeah.
And how would you do that? What were you checking?
Well, we're checking that they were, you know, sort of oiled properly and, you know, sort of right amount of water in and that sort of thing. And there was one strange happening that happened there. They put me on the ARV at that particular period. They were obviously one man short on the ARV.
What's ARV?
The Armed Recovery Vehicle, which was the chin with the top trimmed off. And it was a wonderful crew. I knew nothing about what they were doing. They put me operating in the wireless, which I didn't have got a clue how to operate it.
Had you been trained in it?
No. Well, but, you know, I was a body that was there. So anyway, we got this sergeant sent to us from England, and they used to rely on the sergeant a lot for reading the map and so on and so forth. It was all on mapper, which is when they were calling up for a recovery vehicle. I know what it was. We had an officer sent to us, and I remember his name. It was Voller. And I think he was a captain.
It was what?
Voller. His name's mentioned in some of the books. And I have a feeling that people from the units had known him in the past, because I think he came from the 24th Lancers. Because the 24th Lancers was part of our unit till just prior to D-Day, and they swapped it for the 3rd Tanks. So the 24th Lancers came over before us. I think they landed before us, because we used to get a jibe of, you know, we were here before you, sort of thing. And including that draft was a lot of fitters.
So who was this Voller, Lieutenant Voller?
Voller, I feel he was captain. I think he probably took off, because I think he had been made up to major by then, and they all moved up together.
So what was he doing? What was Voller doing?
Sent his wireless operator to come and take a part of the wireless set out to the ARV. And I said, what are you doing? Oh, he said, Captain, or whatever his name was told to come and get the vibrator unit out of the ARV to put in his tank. So I thought, well, this is a bit rough, because the tanks that had the vibrator attached to that 18 set was so that you could keep it on air much longer than the average, you know, sort of radio. And I said, well, who did you ask? And he said, I don't know. And you give them an order, you give them an order. So anyway, I got hold of Sigs Wilson, who was the signals. It was just a signalman attached to the squadron. And he would, when we thought we went into battle, he'd come round and check all the sets and net them in. And I said, hey, Six, so-and-so has just come over and taken the vibrator unit off this 18th set. He said, did you come and ask him? He said, no. So we went over there and gave Voller a real dressing down, because signals were lords themselves. And he said, how dare you come and take a part of one of my sets for your own use? And the RG-RG, and they were made to replace this particular thing.
Now, what were you doing with the ARV, Sherman? This is just after Goodwood, is it?
Yeah.
And what were you doing?
Well, I was supposed to be operating the wireless set.
How did you manage?
Great difficulty. And the fellow, did they tell you that the sergeant that they sent was, we thought that we could rely on, had come from a unit which dealt only with stationary diesels. So he was a great asset to the ARV crew. Nice fella. But just before we moved over to Bluecoat, a strange thing happened. We had a team of people came round, and what they were doing was plotting out the position of each tank and B vehicle in the area. And apparently, I sort of questioned them, and apparently what they did, or what their job was, different unit altogether, they were, as we moved out, they were replacing our vehicles with dummies, because they didn't want the Germans to know that they'd moved their armour divisions from left to right on the front. And it was a hell of a job, apparently, because they were crossing, I don't know how many lines of, you know, supply. And as we moved out, I didn't actually see it happen, but they would move in the white and the left. And that's when they're blowing up things to replace at that place where Abbey, whatever it was. So when we moved out, if they sent a spotter plane over the next day, they'd still see.
So this is, you were on the ARV vehicle, yeah, while you were at Ardennes Abbey?
Yeah.
But you still haven't told me what you were doing. I mean, were you actually doing any tank rescue or...
No, there was no call for it, thank God. Because, I mean, the sergeant was supposed to be the man with the knowledge.
So, what's the next thing you remember? This would be Operation Blue Coat, then?
Yeah.
And what do you remember of that? This is basically the advance, isn't it? Past Falaise and the rest of it.
It was a very well mixed battle, that. Very well mixed. And they were swapping units. They split them down into, instead of separate armoured and infantry divisions, they took two tank regiments and put two infantry with them for close contact with them. And apparently it worked very well. And the thing that sticks out in my mind more than anything, and I think it was with the ARV at the time, and I don't know, I felt a bit queasy, and I could see the MO's half track, you know, just the other side of the field. So I said, I'm going over to see the MO. And then I just forget what it was. And I went over, and there was about three or four of us standing down there, and our MO, everybody used to, because he wouldn't give him, you know, any time out of battle. He thought he was a German. His name was Luca. And they reckon he was a very good surgeon. You know, if anybody was losing a limb, he was the man that would do it. And I went over, and there was three or four of us standing by the back of this. He had an armoured half-track thing. The doctor, and the padre came along, and he was having a conversation with the MO, and the MO saying, "No, certainly not, padre. I'm not going to allow that at all," which is very unusual for somebody to go against the padre. And he said, "No," he said, "I'm not." He said, "Why?" So he said, "Well, how would you think if you were put on an ambulance and saw half a dozen wooden crosses in the same place as you were on a stretcher?" He said, "No, I'm not doing it." So the party said, "I don't know why." So in the end, the conversation went on, and it got a bit heated in the end, and the MO said, "Padre, I don't think you're sorry for the people that are killed." Because his argument was that I can't always get up to the tanks where somebody's been buried and mark the grave. And he said, "I don't like to leave an unmarked grave." So he said, so the padre widened the conversation out a bit to the group. And he said to me, I knew the padre pretty well at this point, I'll tell you something about that. But anyway, he said to me, "What do you think?" I said, "I wouldn't like to give a straight answer to it. You know, I'm not a religious person, but on my own thoughts." So he said, okay. He said, "Are you a Christian? Never attended any services." I said, "Yes." So he said, "Well, where do you hope to go when you die?" Straight answer, you think. So I said, "Heaven, I suppose." He said, "Well, think about it. They are there. You are not." In my opinion, that was one of these things, but it was straight from him. There was no messing about with him. He was always the same. Very conscientious about, you know, the burials of these people. And I thought, well, you know, and I said to people, he said, "Well, what a, you know, thing to say. It's almost like a, you know, sort of one of these situations where you die and go to Valhalla, whatever it is, you know." So I said, "No, that was the padre all over." And everybody said the same thing about him. He never swore, he never smoked, he never drank, except coffee, I think. But he was a man that was very well respected.